So today we're going to do James chapter 4. It's the chapter with four therefores. So chapter 4 has four therefores. And of course, anytime we see a therefore, we want to see what it's there for. And these therefores are going to kind of drive the logic of this chapter. Now, chapters 1 through 3 of James, we've seen that what James wants us to do is win at life through walking in the wisdom of God, in the ways of God, by faith, instead of walking in the ways of the world. And it's been a very consistent theme that he's repeated multiple times, and nothing's going to change today. So let's just start with 4:1. Where do wars and fights come from among you? Do they not come from your desires for pleasure that war in your members? You lust and do not have. You murder and covet and cannot obtain. You fight and war, yet you do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask amiss, that you may spend it on your pleasures. Adulterers and adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Whoever therefore, so there's our first therefore, whoever therefore wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Okay? So, if you want to be a winner, and this book is all about winning, what's the easiest way to be a winner? If you want to root for the winning team, what's the easiest thing to do if you're going to root for the winning team? Figure out who the best team is and then become a fan of them, right? Isn't that the best way to do? You know, the biggest selling jerseys is the New England Patriots because they've won a bunch of Super Bowls. It's a very logical thing to do. So what he wants us to do here is get on the winning team. And this kind of goes back to some of the other lessons we've had. There's kind of this gear shift thing that we have in life where we're either in the world gear or we're in the God gear. And there's no in between. There's no like middle ground where you can have a little of each. We're one or the other. So the best way to get on the winning team is to choose the winning team. And the winning team is God's team. But what he says here is that if we try to have some of the world, it just pollutes being on God's team. We can't do it. And it makes us an adulterer or an adulteress. And unless you say, think to yourself, well, that can't be talking about a believer. Remember, the word brethren's in here 15 times. He never changes audience. He's always talking to believers. And that made abundantly apparent in verse 5. Or do you think that the Scripture says in vain, the Spirit who dwells in us yearns jealously? This reminds me of Galatians chapter 5. Let's just go there real quick. It's a classic text that we really can't go over too often because it's our daily existence. Galatians chapter 5, verse 16. I say then, walk in the Spirit, and you shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. So we've got these two things going on inside of us all the time. Lust of flesh, and the Spirit is lusting. Verse 17, for the flesh lusts against the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh. And these are contrary to one another. They're enemies. They're competing. The Spirit and the flesh are. And what are they competing for? They're competing for us. We are the chooser. We're the ones that might shift the gear knob to decide which of these is going to have the dominance in us. There's no mix and match. There's no little of this and a little of that. It's one or the other. We get to choose, but we choose one or the other. So, which is it going to be? And it's pretty strong words here. James says, you know, if and when we choose the world, we're an adulterer, an adulteress. Now, why would that be? Well, we are all the bride of Christ. One of the things I like to tell women when I get a chance to talk to them about this subject is we as males need you to show us what it means to be a faithful bride. Because your example is how we're supposed to act to our husband, Jesus. We're supposed to be responsive. We're supposed to follow that husband's lead. And if you haven't noticed, it's not a bent of males to do anything anybody else says at any time. We kind of like to do things our own way. It's a problem for us. Okay? But it's a problem for us all because we have this pleasure inside of us. Let's just flip back to chapter 1 real quick. We have seen this before. He says, verse 13, let no one say when he's tempted, I'm tempted by God. Because he just told us to have joy when we encounter various trials because God lets us go through difficult circumstances. And those difficult circumstances are a fantastic opportunity for us to prove our faith and have it refined like gold. It's an awesome opportunity for us. But it's not a temptation. Temptation comes from within us. Let no one say when he's tempted, I'm tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone. Each one is tempted when he's drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Then, when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. Sin, when it's full grown, brings forth death. So we still, as believers, have this opportunity because we've got this problem inside of us, this flesh. The flesh is still there. And to the extent we nurture it, or to the extent we follow it, we get sin and death. The consequences still come. Well, so isn't this an esteem problem? I mean, if we say, okay, well, I'm a rotten, miserable individual, aren't we violating the thing that we've all been told in our generation, that the most important thing we can do is love ourselves? The most important thing we can do is think highly of ourselves. You got to love yourself before you can love others. You got to esteem yourself before you can have the foundation to benefit others. Isn't that what we've been told? And this seems to run in the face of that pretty severely, doesn't it? You know, they've done some surveys. You know what segment of the population has the highest self-esteem? Prison inmates. Turns out that when you think really highly of yourself, no matter what you do, you can do some pretty heinous things. Okay? The Bible doesn't really want us to have false enthusiasm about ourselves. It wants us to have reality about ourselves. So, does this mean that what we should do is just quit life and go to a convent or a monastery and flagellate ourselves and say, woe is me all the time? Well, let's go on. Because he tells us, therefore, if we want to be a friend of the world, then we're an enemy of God. So enemies of God are going to get negative consequences, right? So we don't want that. We don't want the consequences of the world. We want the consequences of God. So what would we do? Well, or do you think the Scripture says in vain, the Spirit who dwells in us yearns jealously, but He gives more grace? Isn't that a cool answer? So what do we do if we come to this reality that, hey, I'm a miserable, broken person that's self-seeking and has these pleasures that are weighing me down, and I'm just kind of sunk. I'm on the wrong team by my nature. What do I do? Well, he's going to tell us what to do here. He says, therefore, given this condition of reality that we're going to see ourselves with, what's the first step? The first step is to realize, God gives a lot of grace. Isn't that the opposite of what you would think? Let's just go through this and you sing to somebody, hey, you're a miserable, wretched sinner. You're a drunk. You're a selfaholic. You're arrogant. You're controlling. Have I stepped on everybody's toes yet? What else do I need to do? Somebody help me if I hadn't gotten you. Okay, that's pretty broad categories, all right? You are this problematic person, and you need to get better. Well, let's just think about what we've done through history. What have we done through history to get better? Well, I've mentioned monasteries. I can't do anything but evil, so I'm just going to go off where there's no negative environment. I'm going to spend all day in prayer and reading the Bible, and I'm not going to speak. That way, I can't have an evil tongue. That's if I never say anything. If I never say anything, I can't have an evil tongue. I'm completely walled off, and I'm going to be a holy person. And because everybody can't do that, if you can't do that, then you support one of those monastics, and your money that you did to support the monastic kind of, you know, gives you the bragging rights for their holiness. Well, that's been a big movement in our history. Or you set up a system of rules. Okay, we got to get better, so let's have a program. Let's have a daily spiritual boot camp. And we've had all kinds of those. We've had relics. You know, go get the magic relic and get connected with that somehow. We went to a cathedral in France It's a beautiful, fantastic cathedral with these amazing stained glass windows. It was in Chart. I'm sure I pronounced that wrong. It was spelled like Chart. The cathedral was built in like 11 years. I was like, wow, how'd that happen? I thought all these cathedrals always took 100 years to build. And they said, no. The reason they took 100 years to build wasn't because it took so long. It's because they just built it as the money came in. But this one had tons of money. Why? They had a relic everybody wanted to be in on. I forget what it was. I think it was like Mary's covering or Jesus's covering or something like that. So everybody wanted to get in on this relic. Why? Well, because they realized this problem here. I'm really a miserable, wretched person. I need to get better. So what I'm going to do is get in on this relic, and the magic of the relic that makes me okay. Or we have the daily things. You know, for thousand years in Christianity, you have to go get the magic wafer every week. You got to go get the, you know, confession consistently. You got to light your candles. That's 1,000 years. And then, of course, Protestantism came along, and we replaced that with the daily devotional, the Methodist movement, which was started by the Wesleys. You have a method, and you get up every morning at 5 o'clock, and for 2 hours you sing hymns and do Bible study, and that's carried over into kind of the segment of evangelicalism we're in. Okay, how is your devotional life? If I want to ask you a real spiritual question, how is your devotional life? Like somehow, how long and what, and you know, when you get up and all that kind of stuff is a measure of how you're doing. Well, you know, this doesn't say any of that. This doesn't say anything about, okay, because we have this massive problem inside of us, that we have this lust for pleasure, this flesh, therefore, find a method. Therefore, do a retreat. Therefore, it doesn't say any of that. It says, therefore, God gives more grace. That's why we need more grace all the time, because we can't fix this. It's just a fundamental problem. You know what's cool about that? It means we don't have to justify ourselves. We can just receive daily God's grace. Therefore, He gives more grace. But then He goes on. Therefore, He says, God resists the proud, but give grace to the humble. Now, here's the problem with all of those things that we've talked about, monasticism and everything else. They're all self-improvement programs. And you know what? If you have a fundamental nature problem, you can't improve it. I'm a living example of this. All of us are. So what do we do? Well, God resists the proud, but give grace to the humble. Now, this is a problem for us because we've all been taught that grace is unmerited favor. So when we say He gives grace to the humble, it's hard for us to process what that means, because it sounds like He gives grace to people based on what they do, and we've been told you get grace not based on what you do. So let's work this out. Now, let me work with you on this word grace for a minute. It's the Greek word charis, C-H-A-R-I-S. We get our English word charismatic from this. A person who's charismatic is a person who gets great favor based on the way they act. Okay, they act in a very favorable way. Well, all charis means is favor. And I want to show you, if you'll look at Luke 2:52, I'll show you this. Luke 2:52 says, and this is about Jesus when he's a boy, and Jesus increased in wisdom and stature and in favor, charis, could be translated grace, because it's the same Greek word, and in favor with God and men. And this is a bone that I have to pick on an ongoing basis with theologians and translators. They give us these technical theological definitions as though the Bible always means that when the word pops up. And then they use the English word when it fits the technical definition. They use a different English word when it doesn't. And this just means favor. Now look, there's two kinds of favor that Jesus came under. One was from God, and one was from man. And He increased in favor. Now, why would you increase in favor? It's because of what you're doing. So, is grace always unmerited favor? Well, it's certainly not when it comes to men. We judge based on a standard. We give people favor when they measure up to some standard that we have. And different groups of people have different standards, right? What one group says The president is fantastic because they have one set of measurements. And another group says this president is evil and horrible because they have a different group of standards. Or fill in the blank with whatever other, you know, athlete or famous person. We have different standards. Men judge based on standards. What does God judge based on? Does God judge based on a standard?
Yes.
Well, yes and no, right? Yeah, the standard is himself. What God doesn't do is have a standard external to himself. There's no standard that's above God. See, when we judge, there's always a standard that's above us somehow, even if we don't think there is. Think of an Olympic diver. Okay, the guy comes out in his little, you know, too small swimsuit, and then he does his little dive, and it's so fast, you're like, what happened? This is just turning in the air. And then the judges all hold up a card. And there's like eight of them. Why do they need eight? Because they throw out the high and low. Why do they throw out the high and low? Because they're humans, right? They're fallible. And then there'll be somebody, you know, eight and a half, eight and a half, eight and a half, five. And they'll say, and this doesn't happen so much anymore, but it used to back like during the Cold War. And say, why is that person a five? Oh, it's because they're a Russian and this is America. Right? They're biased. They are not following the rules. Right? Because there's this standard. And the judge is saying, like, okay, based on the standard, this is what I gave them. And that's kind of how we do in life. We're all kind of diving judges, you know? The lady comes by, hey, how are you? And all the women say, oh, you see her makeup's all smooth. You see her, look at those shoes. Those are hideous, aren't they? Right? Especially junior high, like that. Okay, so, or the guys, you know, hey, how's it going? Like, oh, that guy, you know, I can't think of an example. Grumble, grumble. Do we have these external standards that we judge with? God doesn't have that. God judges based on himself. Now, does God give unmerited grace? Well, yes, in the sense that he gives favor based on what he decides to do. He always decides. We will never be able to stand before God and say, hey, you gave me a 7.0 and you weren't following the rules. My dive of my life was a 9.5, and let me show you why. Now God said, oh, God, well, I kind of messed up. I didn't see those. There isn't anything like that. When God judges, he judges based on himself for whatever reasons he decides to judge, and that's it. That's the way it's going to be. Now, is God going to make distinctions? Well, think of the parables. One guy comes in at 8 a.m., works all day long. God comes in at the end, or the master does, and says, I'm going to give you a day's wages. And another guy comes in at 3 p.m. and works for 2 hours. He says, I'm going to give you a full day's wages. And the guys that worked all day said, wait a minute. Wait a minute. That's not fair to us. And the master looks at him and says, you got a problem with me wanting to be generous to somebody else? Right? So God is going to grade however he wants to. To whom much is given, much is expected. What does that mean? To whom little is given, little is expected, right? And who's going to decide who's given much and who's given little? Us? No. So God judges based on however he wants to judge. But does he judge based on what he sees? Does he judge based on what we do? Yes, he does. God resists the proud but gives grace to the humble. Here's the question. Who decides what's proud and what's humble? Is there some standard external to God that we can use to argue with God? No. But is God going to look at us and say, who needs more favor based on what we do? Yes. So, we have this problem. We have lust, and we have desire for pleasure, and we have the flesh. And that will put us on the losing team. And so, how do you get off the losing team onto the winning team? Well, you get humility. You become humble. And you get more grace, more favor, when the more humble you get. Okay? So if you got this fundamental problem, you can't fix it. There is no self-improvement program that will make it better. And that's going to keep you off the winning team. You're not going to get consequences of winning if you don't get away from that. And there's nothing that you can do to overcome it. But there's more grace and more favor available if you take the path of humility. Therefore what? Well, then let's figure out how to get humble, right? I was with Dr. Anderson one time. He said, you know, I got a medal for humility from my church. And then I started wearing it, and they took it away from me. So, we got to figure out how to get humble. Okay, verse 7, therefore. So he's going to tell us now how to get humble. And we got this problem, therefore, you know, and this problem puts us on the wrong team, therefore get on the right team. We can't fix this, therefore God gives us more favor. And the more we're humble, the more favor we get. So let's figure out how to get humble. That's what we do next. Therefore, this is the third therefore. Submit to God. Now this seems way too simple, doesn't it? Because we would prefer a complex self-improvement program. Why? Because then we're doing it. And what is that? It's pride. Now, here's the interesting thing. Is going to a monastery necessarily going to make you proud or humble? The circumstances aren't going to determine, right? Do you think God blessed a lot of the people that went and got the magic wafer every week? I certainly do, because I bet you a lot of them went because they were submitting themselves to God best they knew how. Or the daily devotional, the Methodist. Okay, if you get up at 5 in the morning for 2 hours, is God going to honor that, or is He going to consider it pride? Well, it kind of depends, right? It depends on the reason you're doing it. So all these things can be fantastic, and all of them can be self-improvement that God would reject. It's not the thing we do. It's the reason we do it that's going to matter. So submit to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Well, that's pretty cool. We've seen already that our flesh is kind of connected to the world, which is connected to Satan, which is connected to the demonic world. It's all kind of part of the same thing. So step number one is resist it. We know we have this pleasures inside of us. We know we have this flesh thing. So resist it. Paul says put it to death. Resist the devil and he'll flee from you. That's pretty cool. You know, demonic forces are huge, huge power centers, incredible power. But if you resist, we get the favor of God chasing them off, apparently. Draw near to God and He will draw near to you. Okay, so what method do we use to draw near to God? Whatever you want to do, whichever method you want to approach. It doesn't say what method to use. All of those methods that could be used to be prideful and to be self-improvement can equally be used to draw near to God. It depends on what heart you do it with. You can be in here today seeking to find some sort of gem that you can use to beat other people up over the head with, and this not going to do you any good. Or you can be here today saying, I want to draw near to God and this helps me do it. Which means you're following the winning team. You're trying to figure out how to get on the winning team. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Lament and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and He will lift you up. Now, how do we do this? So does this mean we're always supposed to be mopey people? Well, I actually have experienced this. I'll give you my little bit of my personal testimony. It's one thing to say, I believe in, what is that phrase the theologian use? I believe in the depravity of man, and I'm depraved. It's easy to say that. But really, really, what I mean by that is, I know I fall in this whole category, but I'm fundamentally better than most everybody else. Okay, that's what we really ingest. So I grew up in a very fundamentalistic, judgmental, legalistic, self-improvement program. That was my church orientation. And so there's some things that you would do to be holy, like be 20 years out of fashion, and not 40. 40 is probably prideful, but 20 out of fashion. And you know, I was in a Bible study group one time when they said. People that wear bell-bottom pants, this was in the 70s, people that wear bell-bottom pants will go to hell. And I do not dispute that there'll be bell-bottom pants in hell. This is probably where that fashion belongs from reality. But you know, it was just indicative of, you know, that's the world. And it's what you do that puts you in the world, not who you are. You know, it wasn't, the emphasis wasn't on the thought thing. It was on these externalities, which you can understand, right? You can understand that it's much easier to deal with tangible things than this intangible faith thing, right? So it's something we gravitate to. So I developed this ability to take my brokenness, my desires for pleasure, my lusting and not having, which for me is basically arrogance and control. I'm a very controlling person. I want to be in charge without having responsibility. That's my flesh nature. Anybody identify with that? So I want to blame others when something goes wrong, but I want to get credit when things go right. That's my fundamental. And I'm actually pretty good at pulling it off, which gives me a positive reinforcement for negative behavior. So I went through my life with this, and certainly had some plenty of wake-up opportunities to realize this is counterproductive. But, you know, I'm also really hard-headed. I came by that naturally, too. And then I came to the point in life where circumstances of life made me come face-to-face with the reality that I'm not getting better. Okay, I would mess up, and I would say to myself, this is my self-talk of, well, I messed up, but I would never do that again. See, I've learned that. I actually said that to myself over and over again. Anybody else identify with that? Yeah. And so I came to this point of realizing I'm an arrogant prick that wants to get control. I'm a terrible leader. I'm not a good leader. I'm a terrible leader. I'm like the inverse of a leader. And you know what that did to me? It made me depressed. So I was in this group of people who only knew me after this had happened. And I was going, I went through 2 years or so of just really being, just I just kind of like had the wind knocked out of me for 2 years. So they had these caricatures they put up on a banner. And they said, you know, there were four partners in this operation I was in. And they'd characterize us and said, you know, which one's you? And I looked up there and I don't know. They said, well, obviously it's this one. They had this Eeyore-ish character, you know, just sitting there kind of like this, emotionless, you know. And, oh my gosh, you know, that was kind of a shock for me because normally I was class clown growing up. I was always the happy guy. But what happened to me was I was mourning. I had my laughter sucked out of me. I was mourning the reality of my condition as a sinner. A fleshly, controlling, arrogant person. Now, why was I mourning something that's good to know? I mean, just think about reality. Don't you want to get away from that thing? Well, you know what I was mourning is my own death. I had spent 40-ish years grooming this thing. I put lipstick on this pig every day. I dressed up this ugly dog every day and pretended it was my child. Okay? And now it has to die. It was painful. It was debilitating for a while. But it was reality. It was coming to see reality for what it is. And when you see reality for what it is, there's a mourning that happens. There's a wake you have to do for yourself. To say, look, I'm a whatever you are. I'm a manipulative, undermining person. I'm a self-destructive person because I know self-destruction gets me attention. Whatever it is, whatever your thing is. And my brother told me he was on this cruise, and this comic said, really rotund guy, you know, significantly overweight, stands up and says, "Hey, listen, I discovered recently, I have dyslexia. I'm not dyslexia. Anorexia. I have anorexia." And everybody laughed. And he said, "No, really. I read that if you look in the mirror and see a fat person, it means you have anorexia." Anyway. So, you know, seeing reality sometimes is a tough thing to get hold of. But when you see reality, like, you know, no, I'm really like this. There should be a period of mourning that you go through. And that's because there's a death that you have to overcome. But then it's verse 17. So humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and He will lift you up. See, my problem was I wanted to be a leader. I wanted to be somebody that made a difference in the world. And I realized I'm just an arrogant prick that's trying to control people. I'm the opposite of a leader. So I had to totally retool everything. Herman helped me a lot. A lot of people helped me, like, this is what a leader really is. And I had to realize, you know, actually a leader is somebody that takes responsibility for other people's mistakes. That's what a leader is. So I had to turn everything I did totally upside down. And I think I'm way better for it. I think it helped me start figure out how to get on the winning team. I think that God gave me grace to show me a path to take, at least to this point. Now, go back to verse 4. Whoever therefore wants to be a friend of the world. See, I did not want to be a friend of the world. I just was. So it's our inner desire. When God sees where you want to go, He's going to give you, He's going to feed things to you. It probably will be painful and there'll be a lot of mourning associated with it, okay? But that's the way it goes. So that's the one therefore. Okay, then the next therefore. Verse 11, do not speak evil of one another, brethren. He who speaks evil of a brother and judges his brother speaks evil of the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you're not a doer of the law, but a judge. There's one lawgiver who's able to save and to destroy. Who are you to judge another? There's a book called The Shack that has a really, really great picture of this, where there's this courtroom scene. And the question is, who's going to sit in the judge's chair? And boy, this is me. I often get a tap on the shoulder. Yes, you're sitting in my chair. Oh, I sure am. Sorry. I need to be out in the courtroom, not up on the die in the judge's chair, right? Because the reality is, when we judge, we are committing idolatry. You know, when we judge in the way that God is supposed to judge, and when we're doing His job. Because we're not God. Paul says, judge nothing before the time. Paul says, I examine myself all the time. This is 1 Corinthians 4. I examine myself all the time, but I don't know of anything bad against me. That doesn't mean I'm going to get a good grade at the judgment seat. I'll find out. You know? Who are you to judge another? God is the judge. And when we judge, we're saying, I'll make the law, I'll make my own rules, and I'll sit in God's chair. You know, you don't know whatever people's story is. We don't know why other people are doing what they're doing. Let's understand strengths and weaknesses. Trying to meet people where they are. People are counterproductive. Let's see if we can help them, you know, invite them to take a better step. But we're not the judge. We don't know. Okay, so that's another way to humble ourselves before God. Don't do God's job. Let Him do the judging. Think about how much weight's lifted off our shoulders when we can let that job go, right? It's really a weighty thing to judge the whole world. So we can stop.
What's the difference between discernment?
Well, you know, people are being counterproductive. They're being counterproductive. I think this isn't talking about judging whether someone's an idiot or not, okay? And some people are idiotic all the time, right? Dave, I work with Dave. He's the butt of jokes all day long, every day. And dishes it out, probably one for one, right? Roughly. Do you keep track? You probably judge that, too. Judging whether somebody's an idiot or not is one thing, but look, why don't we just go through the judging passages here in James? There's like 10 of them. Here's James 1:2-4, and it says, don't judge people with evil motives, which is, somebody comes into your fellowship and you say, hey, here's a rich guy. So you judge, like, what can this person do for me? What you want to do instead is judge, what can I do for them? Okay? Both are judgment, right? One is, and one is evil, and one's good. Another one's James 2:13, and it says, mercy triumphs over judgment. Okay? So I can see that someone's an idiot, but I give them mercy. That's more important than condemning them. And I think the condemnation is the key thing. I think it's not assessing. Assessing, you know, you're assessing. But you don't know why that person's doing it. You don't know what their heart is. And there's no basis upon which to pronounce condemnation. This person's not worth my time. Okay? And what that always is doing is saying, what can they do for me? Right? In one way or the other. James 3:1, teachers get a stricter judgment. Okay? So that's judgment from God. So be careful if you want to be a teacher. James 4:11-12, when we judge others, we elevate ourselves above the law, the one we just did. Okay? James 5:9, always remember that judgment is right around the corner for us. Okay? 5:9 says, do not grumble against one another, brethren, lest you be condemned. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. Okay? What measure you measure to others will be measured to you, right? You can assess, oh, this guy's an idiot. But if you then say, I wonder on what basis I'm an idiot, too. How can I learn from that? And then you say, I wonder what their story is. And then just going down the road, I don't think that creates a measuring stick for you. But if you condemn that person and compare them and say, I'm better than them, you know, I am justified. This self-justification, I think, is the main reason we judge, Tom. And we say, I'm okay because, you know, Dave's obviously insufficient, or because Wally's insufficient. Okay, that makes me okay. But now what we're doing is elevating ourselves, and God does not bless that. He blesses people when they say, I don't know what their story is. I don't know why they did what they did. How can I help them? Is there some way I could help them? Now we're judging, but not with evil motives. We're not taking God's job. And then 5:12 says, speak the truth. Don't just speak the truth when you're under oath. In other words, don't just speak the truth when you know you're going to get in trouble. There's going to be an immediate negative consequence. Speak the truth all the time. And part of the truth may be, you know, while you're being an idiot, let me tell you what you need to be thinking about. Yeah. exactly. All right. So let's finish this up real quick. Then there's one more therefore in verse 17. Therefore, to him who knows to do good and does not do it, to him it's a sin. Okay? Now, why would he put that in there? Verse 13. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we'll go to such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell, make a profit. Whereas you don't know what will happen tomorrow. For what is your life? It's even a vapor that appears for a little time, then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that. But now you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Therefore, to him who knows to do good and does not do it, to him it's a sin. So we've been told all these things not to do. Don't choose the world. Resist the devil. Put to death the flesh. Don't speak evil of other people. Don't judge. So that could lead you to just say, okay, awesome, I just won't do anything. I will just go monastery. So everything's good by me. Everything's okay. I'm fine. You know, whatever you want to do. Que sera, sera. Whatever will be, will be. Whatever you want to do is fine. I'm not your judge. Whatever. Okay? Nope, doesn't work that way. No, if you judge and you see, God, this person's being an idiot, you got to go through this thing of asking myself, is there anything I can do that would help this person? Not condemning, not self-justifying, not comparing, but asking yourself, is there a ministry for me here to this person? Because if there is something you can do, and you don't do that, that's prideful too. That is also sin. We're supposed to be serving others, not lording over them, and not avoiding them. So, are we not supposed to make plans? Absolutely, we're supposed to make plans. We're supposed to make plans to help other people. We're supposed to make plans to bless our communities. We're supposed to make plans to help our families be holy for generations. But here's the thing. We can't control the outcome. You make the plan, and then you say, God, would you please bless this? Because that is humbling yourself, right? If we try to control the outcome, we kind of try to control the result, what are we doing? Actually, that all comes back to self-justification again. See, I'm okay because my child turned out this way. See, I'm okay because my child graduated from college. See, I'm okay because, you know, fill in the blank. No, that's trying to control the future. That's just a function of self-justification. We are just a vapor that's here for a little time. So let's make absolute use of all the time that we have. So what are we supposed to be doing? Well, this is the only chance we get to know God by faith. So, learn, see, know, judge with wisdom. But don't condemn and don't self-justify. Instead, put a plan together and then say, God bless this plan however you choose. I don't demand certain outcomes. I just want to be faithful. Now, look at what that does. That is winning. That gives us the opportunity to say, okay, I am by faith dealing with the circumstances I have, doing what I can do to bless others. That's refining your life as gold, like chapter 1 told us. That is submitting yourself to God. And he says what? If we do that, he will lift us up. That is taking advantage of the time we have here. Because remember, Next life, no faith. No faith in it. Everything will be seen. Heaven will come to earth. And we'll live in the new earth. Everything will be by sight. So by faith, we have this opportunity to know God in this life that we don't know any other. But we can't have faith if we're demanding certain results. And then think about the practicality of that. Now, we have all the meaning in the world because only we have this assignment where we are in our station of life with the people we touch, the way we touch it. Only we have that. Now, that's something to esteem, right? Because God has given us this amazing gift. We have the power of the Spirit within us that we can unleash. And at the same time, we have the opportunity to be lifted up by God. And we don't have the burden of the world on us. We don't have to self-justify. We don't have to judge other people. And we don't have to control outcomes. So the weight of the world is lifted off of us to boot. All the good, none of the bad, if we adopt this perspective. So, winning at life, by walking in wisdom, walking in faith, being on the right team, it isn't just about having a blessing in the next life. It creates an immense blessing right now, because it takes all the pressure off, and it gives us an enablement to live life constructively every day, all day long. God, thank you for this chapter with the four therefores in chapter four that shows us what judgment can do to us negatively and what true judgment can do for us positively, what humility really is, and how to interact with other people constructively. Lord, help us be humble and serve. Help us take what we know is right and do it, but give you the results. Help us, Lord, not create division and fights among one another by our actions, but to create a divide between what's true and what's not true. Help the fight in our world be enmity with the world, not dissension among one another. And Lord, I pray that you just give us your grace, because we have this problem, this flesh problem. Please give us more grace. In Jesus' name, amen.